on 88.1 WYPR. It's Maryland Morning. Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's been 7 months since Ben Jealous, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, issued a report called Toward Trust, Grassroots Recommendations for Police Reform in Baltimore. Many of the recommendations in the report, written in the aftermath of the violence and uprising that followed the death of Freddie Gray, were front and center in the recent mayoral primary campaign. Other recommendations are slated to be implemented soon. Ben Jealous, who is the former president and CEO of the NAACP, joins me this morning to talk about where the city of Baltimore stands 13 months after the uprising and how the conversation about race has or could evolve as our city and other cities around the country attempt to bridge the gap of trust between police and communities of color. The conversation about race, and in particular black men, has been front and center at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. This is the Year of the Black Male at the Lewis Museum. Their current exhibition is an innovative video installation called Question Bridge. Charles Bethay is the chief curator and director of collections and exhibitions at the Lewis Museum. Ben Jealous and Charles Bethay join me in the studio. Morning, gentlemen. Thanks so much.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Ben Jealous, we've had 13 months since the uprising. The Freddie Gray anniversary has come and gone. There have been plenty of panels and pundits and poets weighing in on this over the past year. Has the dial on inequality, which was clearly at the heart of the uprising, has it moved? And in what ways do you think it might have moved in these past 13 months in particular?
You know, look, I think the biggest change has been on consensus. I think folks understand just how serious this is. We saw it come up in the Democratic primary race. It was kind of front and center. And one of the interesting things, I mean, just to get outside of Baltimore for a second, and then we'll come right back to it, is as a national surrogate for Bernie Sanders, wherever I went, we could be in Chicago, we could be in Baltimore, we could be in Atlanta, or we could be in the Ozarks, or we could be in Spartanburg. This issue got huge response from the audience. Well, the audience was half black or 90% white and 10% in camouflage because they're about to go deer hunting. You know, like the reality is, I think the
media. So this is on everybody's mind.
It's on everybody's mind. And the media has done a good job of telling the story of the glass half empty, telling the story of the FOP that hasn't quite got, you know, caught up with the times, or the FBI director who's stuck in some fantasy land thinking that this is actually driving up the murder rate because people now, you know, are paying attention to these issues, or, you know, the crowds at the Donald Trump rallies. What the media has not done a good job talking about is that, again, I could be at a rally in the Ozarks, the crowd's 90% white and 10% are in camouflage, and everybody cheers and applauds when Bernie Sanders calls for an end to the police killing of unarmed black men, just like we were in Chicago. And so that is real progress. And the reality is that this issue probably is the most similar that we've confronted as a country since we began 100 years ago to confront lynch mob violence. This is one of those issues that really legislation, I mean, we're going to pass it, but what's really going to have to change our hearts and minds, the most powerful weapon that the movement has really is shame. And so it's heartening when you see deer hunters on fire to end police brutality. It's heartening when you realize that these young people lighting up Twitter actually has an impact. And so, you know, I'm hopeful for those reasons. Now, here in Baltimore, I was very disheartened to see the commissioner respond the way he did when his, just after his police officers had shot a young teenager, a boy, with a BB gun. And, you know, the witnesses that have come forward.
He's 13 years old.
He's 13
and the officer,
years old.
Of course, contends that it looked like a real gun.
Right. But the bullet enters around his collarbone, comes out his lower back. The witnesses say that's because he was bending over with his hands up. He had dropped the gun, the BB gun, and was no threat to anybody. And to see the commissioner come out and talk about the boy's mom rather than talk about the people he's responsible for, which are those officers, without any sense that this simply never happens to white boys, no matter how often they play with BB guns. And there's a lot of white boys with BB guns. So there's still work to be done here. And I think the commissioner, you know, has made some progress. You know, I've praised him in the past. But this time, his utter defensiveness about his officers, just moments after, when he knows that you need to do the investigation, you need to talk to the witnesses, and at best he had half the story, he should not have been out there running his mouth talking about some boy's mom. He should have been out there, frankly, as the leader of the police force, expressing concern about the behavior of his officer.
It's Commissioner Kevin Davis, you're talking about, the commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department. Charles Bethay, Rodney Foxworth Jr. Has an essay in a book that Ben edited, which is a collection of essays by 40 black men speaking on living, leading, and succeeding. He says that we've got to change the context and conversation around black men. Question Bridge, this video installation that you have at the Lewis right now, the Lewis Museum, is asking a wide range of questions. In what way is it changing the context, do you think?
Well, it's doing a couple of things. It's allowing, you know, black men to ask questions among themselves about themselves, and doing it in a forum that allows everyone who's not black to get a better insight and understanding of what's going on in folks' minds. Realistically, I mean, the questions range from, you know, the most adorable young man asking, about 6-7 years old, how do you know when you become a man? To people asking questions of, am I a traitor if I date outside of my race? What does it mean when I eat foods that are, you know, stereotypical, such as watermelon or fried chicken and so forth? What does it mean to other people, and how do I feel? How do I internalize that? How do I deal with the fact that I may be a homosexual in a community that does not necessarily look, you know, highly upon that particular demographic? So all of these questions are very interesting, and they're very poignant, because what's happening is that these are questions that were created by, you know, African-American males to be answered by other African-American males across the country. And the way things have been going on in this country for a number of years, and, you know, as a historian, I want to, you know, go back to something that Ben just made a point of. People need to know what's going on out in the street. And one thing, the wonderful thing about living in the 21st century is this digital age, where everything goes onto that handheld computer that also happens to make phone calls that everyone walks around with now. And that information is disseminated throughout the world instantly. Now, here's the unfortunate thing. These acts and so forth have been going on forever. But we are now in an age where that the awareness of them are starting to have a more of an impact on folks. That's why you can be out in the Ozarks and see, you know, groups of people who are on the same side of, well, police brutality is police brutality. And all of that still plays into fact with this particular exhibition, Question Bridge, Black Males, which is the full title, as, you know, black males are asking these questions among themselves. You know, how do you interact with the police? Why do you have to tell your young male sons, well, if you're ever stopped by a police officer, this is what you need to do? It's a laundry list of things that you're being told, which other ethnic groups do not have to do. So,
Charles Bethay is the chief curator of collections and exhibitions at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. Ben Jealous, the former director of the NAACP, now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Ben, you mentioned how shame is perhaps one of the biggest and best arrows in the quiver. Is it a matter of these folks in their, you know, deer hunting outfits in the Ozarks? Is it a matter of them being unaware of what would happen, or finally, in fact, saying to themselves, mama wasn't right, daddy wasn't right, grandpa wasn't right, grandma wasn't right, and really coming around? Are these hearts and minds changing? Because on the other hand, you've got the Sanders campaign wrestling with, at least initially, you know, acceptance in the black community itself.
Right. You know, look, the reality is, I mean, those are two very different things, right? You know, I think on the issue of police brutality, every community, when you poll them, actually has concerns about how their own community is treated. And so I think what's actually changing isn't people criticizing their grandparents. Actually, their grandparents were right, but what's right for us is also right for them, right? That concern about us being mistreated, maybe in a rural area by a sheriff, is no more valid than somebody has in the inner city about also being mistreated. And I think popular culture, the internet, frankly, the passage of time has had a lot to do with people's sort of generational ability to see each other in each other, regardless of color. At the same time, the reality is, and so the shame, you know, may just simply come by being the officer who holds a different opinion, who's at that rally for a bunch of other reasons, and looking around and saying, oh my gosh, it's I'm on the outside on this one. You know, lynch mob violence in our country was very normal for a very long time. And the thought was, and this is why the FBI...
And not too long ago.
No, and not too long ago. And this is why the FBI director's comments, and he's made them again, I think his name is Comey.
James Comey.
Yes, the head of the FBI has come out and said, all this increased scrutiny of the cops has convinced them to not do their job, essentially. Now the crime rate's coming up. And it's problematic. And he's like, you know, and especially these, you know, he has a real thing against... video cameras, especially, you know, these cameras, and now they feel, you know, self-conscious and they're not just engaging the way that they should. It was the exact same logic for lynch mob violence. The idea was you had to deal with it right away. You had to deal with it harshly or it was going to spread. And so it's the same thing with police brutality. You have to deal with them right away. You have to deal with it harshly or crime's going to get worse. And so that logic is just, you know, the more people are confronted with what actually happens. You know, Tamir Rice in Ohio, maybe that was an exotic incident, a 13-year-old boy being shot and killed by the cops. Maybe he was 12, playing with a BB gun in the park. And then it happens right here in Baltimore. And Commissioner Davis comes out, and he's very harsh. He's very defensive about the officers. And then the facts start coming out. And it appears that the guy, had, you know, the child had dropped the gun, and he still got shot. And that's when folks in the suburbs and the exurbs and the rural areas start saying, no, this is just wrong.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, my guests this morning are Ben Jealous and Charles Bethay. Ben Jealous is the former president and CEO of the NAACP. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a partner at the Kaper Center for Social Impact. Charles Bethay is the chief curator and director of collections and exhibitions at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. It's been more than a year since violence tore through Baltimore following the funeral of Freddie Gray. Problems of racial and economic inequality that were laid bare during and after that difficult week last spring have been present for decades. The Lewis Museum has declared this the Year of the Black Male. Their current exhibition, a video installation called Question Bridge, Black Males, is part of a larger conversation about race that's taking place here and around the country in the context of an extraordinary political season on both the local and national levels. Charles Bethay, let me play a little clip of some of the from some of the video as part of this installation called Question Bridge, Black Males.
How has your financial success or your educational success compromised who you feel that you are on the inside for what you feel that people want you to be?
It has not changed me at all. What has changed is people's perception of who I am and what I'm about.
This may seem like a silly question, but I want to know, am I the only one who has problem eating chicken, watermelon, and bananas in front of white people?
I don't know if you're the only one, but it is not a problem for me to eat whatever I want to eat in front of anybody.
So this question is for all the black gay men that are out there. How do you really feel about yourself? Are you frightened about living openly in this country? What do you do in order to survive as a full human being?
I live openly as a black gay man, but it took some time for me to get to that place because I, for many years, was invested in what other people thought about me. But when I decided to love myself more than what other people thought about me, then all the pieces fell into place.
Excerpts from Question Bridge, Black Males, a video installation currently at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum here in Baltimore. Charles Bethay, how has the story of the African-American experience, the telling the story, the way the narrative is put out there, how has that changed, do you think, since the uprising a year ago? I mean, that everybody seems to say that that's a demarcating moment in the history of our city. Are you finding that as you put these kinds of exhibitions together in this Year of the Black Male?
Well, I believe it is for the community at large, but most African-American museums, particularly the Reginald F. Lewis Museum, has always tried to tell this story and do this interpretation of African-American history and culture. From a standpoint and a viewpoint, this is American culture. This has been going on. This is a part of who we all are. I mean, after all, we weren't lynching ourselves. So African-American history is a part of the overall context of American history. So we try to approach these storylines for a place where people can see themselves in these exhibitions, in these particular stories, whether or not you're white, black, purple, green, or other. You will see yourself as an American.
Ben Jealous, in terms of the national campaign for president, both on the Democratic and the Republican side, what do you think the effect on the so-called conversation about race. What do you think the Trump effect the Trump candidacy has been on that conversation. It seems to me that Trump is giving voice to a lot of bigotry, a lot of intolerance that perhaps heretofore had been at the very least suppressed. I mean, it seems that Trump is giving people permission to say things that they simply wouldn't say out loud, even if they thought it. They wouldn't say it out loud a year ago, a year and a half ago. Is it corroding this conversation, and is it what's the effect in your estimation?
You know, Donald Trump is absolutely encouraging an incivility in our politic in this country that takes us backwards, and that makes vulnerable groups feel more vulnerable in many ways. He says we should not let Muslims on planes or allow them to immigrate. We need to build a wall with Mexico. He refers to Mexicans as rapists, and then he tries to kind of walk it back a little bit. And the reality is he is likely to do very well this fall. Whether he wins or not remains to be seen. But I have no doubt that he will come close one way or the other. And it's in part because his kind, celebrity, conservative populists, do very well. And we always laugh at them first. We laughed at Ronald Reagan in 79 when he wanted to be president.
Yeah, he's just an actor.
Yeah, yeah, he became president. You know, we laughed at Jesse the Body Ventura when he ran for governor. He became governor. We laughed at Arnold Schwarzenegger. In fact, we were certain Arnold Schwarzenegger would lose because he was running against Cruz Bustamante, who would have become the first Latino governor of California, which is like over 40% of the population is Latino. It would be a big deal that pride and everything would drive them out. Didn't happen. But he reminds me in some ways most of a guy named Kirk Fordyce. Kirk Fordyce ran for governor of Mississippi in the late 1980s in an era when Clinton was governor of Arkansas, and we considered the New South to be solid and New South Democrats to be unbeatable. And we were faced in Mississippi with this guy named Kirk Fordyce, who was not a politician. He was a businessman, a successful contractor who had made a name for himself challenging 10% minority set-asides in a state that was 35% black. He had been at all the same social events, quote-unquote, as David Duke the year before. He was known to have white supremacist leanings, and he spoke like
Duke, who ran for Congress in Louisiana, and his primary got 25% of the vote.
No, that's right, but he also had served as a state senator while being Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan of Louisiana in the 1980s. And so, interesting thing was, Kirk Fordyce was way out on the right. He was so far out that many Republicans, similar to what's going on now, oh, he's an embarrassment, I don't agree with him, he's embarrassing, blah, blah, blah. He keeps running to the right. This peer of then-Governor Clinton, I believe it was Governor Mabus, but I will admit, I get Mapus and Malpus confused in the history of Mississippi governors. Anyways, the incumbent is running and intends to track to the right. Doesn't like to be too outflanked. He eventually moves so far to the right a week before the election that he basically insults the entire black citizenry of Mississippi, who then does not turn out to vote in very significant numbers. And he loses to Kirk Fordyce, who becomes governor. Now, this is the interesting thing. Everybody said he was an embarrassment and he was so right-wing and he had no experience and da-da-da. No way he was going to win. He wins. 2 years later, white Mississippi Republicans, I'm down there as an organizer, and you hear them saying, yeah, I feel liberated. I can just say what I think now. You know, the governor has created space for me to speak honestly. And what they're talking about is giving voice to hatred and intolerance. And
Trump's people use the term of art, telling it like it is.
Yeah, no, no, no.
That's what it is,
yes,
in their
no,
minds.
No, yeah. I mean, and that's just, and, you know, and that's exactly right. And so that's, I think, you know, in some ways, that's why I think the sort of the opposite narrative, this other populist campaign, Bernie Sanders is so important. Less what we've been fixated on, what percentage of the black vote he's getting. It's like, what percentage of the white vote is he getting? And why are they turning out in millions to vote for this guy who has talked about racial justice since the early 1960s? And sure, while he was in Vermont, it may have been eclipsed by his talk about economic justice, but it never left his vernacular. He delivered the state of Vermont for Jesse Jackson. And so I think it's important, if only so guys like Charles and I can get out of bed in the morning, you know, to keep focus on the fact that the glass is not just half empty,
right,
that it's also half full.
Yeah. And Charles, Ben brings up a thing that a lot of folks have written about, thought about, and that is the level of political engagement among people of color, Obama's election in 2008, it was certainly up. It was elevated, not elevated quite as high in 2012. I wonder here on the local level, this last election for city council and mayor, which of course hasn't been certified yet, but eventually we'll have real and trustworthy totals. There is a new group of young African-American leaders. I think of folks like Brandon Scott, who already held a position, but some new people who ran for the first time, Leon Pinkett, Shannon Sneed. These are folks who are, you know, coming onto the city council. Are you sensing in your work at the Lewis Museum that there is an increasing level of engagement in the political process among people of color?
Well, yeah, I think there is. And, you know, there are these younger folks, these younger generation that is moving that needle a little bit more. But if you look at history, that's always been the case. There's always been a younger generation, you know, on the pulse, pushing things along. And that's no different now. I think that, and to go back to another point that Ben made earlier, I think that one of the things that Trump has done very successfully is remind people the level of fascism that still exists in America, because he has become this lightning rod for people, for a group that has gotten so marginalized and so pushed to the, you know, to underneath the table and underneath the rug, that we sort of kind of forgot that they actually existed on the level and the scale that they do. And with this movement of younger African-American folks getting involved in the political arena, getting involved in the, you know, civic and social engagement in their particular areas, I think that's another replaying of history, you know, unfolding as we're living right now. You know, Du Bois said the biggest issue of the 20th century is going to be race. We're still talking about that same issue in the 21st century. So we still have a little ways to go. And I think that these younger folks are going to be those torchbearers that are going to advance that message further.
Charles Bethay from the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. We're joined by Ben Jealous as well. He's the former director of the NAACP and currently a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Ben, there's a fellow that I talked to a couple months ago named Steve Phillips. He's from San Francisco University. Mm-hmm. He writes about the fact that there's enough of a progressive wing of white voters in this country. It's not the whole the white community by any means, but there's a community. It's at 30% by some estimates. That if that were combined with people of color voting regularly and actively and being politically engaged, that would be more than enough to offset any of the so-called white swing voters that in the past elections people have concentrated so much. He also did this wonderful thing called the Fannie Lou Hamer audit, in which he found out that the candidates chasing these white swing voters happened to be managed, their campaigns managed by white political operatives who spent $500 million chasing these white swing voters and still lost a whole bunch of elections.
Yeah.
I mean, does Steve Phillips have a point? Is that
no? Steve does.
Is that a doable goal? I mean, can there be a progressive coalition put together?
No, Steve does. He's a real visionary. He and I came together in 2008 with another guy named Andy Wong, and we created an effort called Vote Hope that was critical in Obama's victories in the primary states over Hillary Clinton. So Steve knows what he's talking about. Yes, I mean, it's clear right here in Maryland. I mean, I go back to 2012, 2013. We progressive leaders in the state were considering trying to abolish the death penalty, pass marriage equality, pass the DREAM Act, pass sensible gun safety reforms, and expand voting rights. And the first three were considered to be very controversial, and the second two relatively controversial. And there was a lot of, you know, wise, typically old men who said, please, not all at once. I mean, come on, you know.
Don't bite off more than you can chew.
Right. And it was the young activists who stood up and said, let's just do arithmetic. Like, if you stand down on the DREAM Act, these activists will stand down. And if you stand down on the death penalty, like when it was Frederick Douglass from this state who gave it to the civil rights movement as an objective, you know, these folks will stand down. And issue by issue. And their point was that in politics, coalitions add up. And so I knew we were in a good place when I walked out my front door and there was a group of college students who lived next to me in a kind of a group house. And they had one sign that said, pass marriage equality, abolish the death penalty, pass the DREAM Act. And that was the whole, and we won all those battles. And Martin O'Malley and I, who were, you know, kind of right in the war room, and a couple of them, together will tell you, a lot of folks said we had no chance. But what you saw was, yes, the black community stood up, the Latino community stood up, but a huge fraction of the white community stood up, too. You know, when we talk about race relations, we aren't talking a lot about black folks. we need to have a similarly nuanced conversation about the white community. And especially in a state like Maryland, where you have, you mean, you run the entire spectrum here of politics that white people could possibly have in this country, in this one state.
Well, unfortunately, we've got to stop our conversation here, but we will continue this on the web at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Ben Jealous, Charles Bethay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ben Jealous is the former president and CEO of the NAACP. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the editor of the book Reach, 40 Black Men Speak on Living, Leading, and Succeeding. Charles Bethay is the chief curator and director of collections and exhibitions at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. 2016 is the year of the black male at the Lewis Museum. The current exhibition is a video installation called Question Bridge, Black Males. It's there until the end of September. For more information, visit our website at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Coming up a little later in the program, the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, on why the biggest losers lost a lot more than weight. But first, it's time now for our regular Wednesday feature, The Environment in Focus.